is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Steve Bobe.
Taking care of business and working overtime.
With market insights and so much more, talk to Steve now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Steve Bobe.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Money Talk Show. This is AM 790, your station for talk and business. Although the Trump stock market, we'll call it, for just for laughs. There's a lot more to the stock market than the president, I assure you of that, folks. And eventually in the long run, that will be proven, as it always will be. Company earnings are what drive stock prices eventually. Along the way, there can be distractions, but eventually that's what will control it all. The Dow Jones are down 69 points to 20,855. The NASDAQ closed at 58.37, up 3. And the S&P was up a smidgen at 23.62. It's tax time, folks. If you're self-employed like me, like us, you're a hybrid. You're kind of a hybrid. Anyway, if you have some self-employment income, let's put it that way, at all, you may have an opportunity right now. If taxes are reduced, then making contributions for 2017 may be an advantage, making them now versus the end of the year, depending on whether or not tax changes are retroactive or not. But let's say, for example, we get a tax law change in September that's not retroactive. So anything, you know, only things after September that are done are under the new rules, or maybe the following year. Any tax deduction you got for making a contribution to an IRA or a SEP account, SEP, Simplified Employee Pension. I have one of those and have had it for 25 years. Most self-employed people like me who don't have employees, but I do have employees, but I don't technically for tax purposes. So it's a nice simple way of a small business saving for retirement, Simplified Employee Pension. Again, if a federal tax bracket, let's say there could be 10% lower 10 months from now, then putting the contribution in now can't hurt. And it, depending on how the laws go down, it may be the last chance you get to take an IRA deduction at that high rate. Keep in mind, this is the baffling world of money, folks. We all want lower taxes, right? Everyone. Until it comes time to take your tax deductions at the end of the year, then the higher your bracket is, the more powerful the deduction is. So contributions now for 2017 instead of waiting until the end of the year might be an advantage, depending on what the tax law has actually done. Tonight is Wednesday night, and as usual, Nathan and I will be talking about some part of financial history. And Nathan, you chose the 70s, huh?
Yeah, very unique and tumultuous time in our economy. And I say unique just because the conditions that were apparent at that time, you didn't see very often. You don't see very often. And it centers around this odd term that I mentioned last week when we talked about the savings and loans crisis, stagflation, which was a term that had to be invented in the middle of the 20th century to describe the economic conditions that were going on in our economy. So we'll talk a little bit about what led to those conditions and what the government did to try to combat the rampant inflation that was going on.
From 1970 to the end of 1979.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
That was, I was age 11 to 21.
That's right. Right.
Started my career right at the tail end of that, at the end of the 70s.
Right. The stagflation period usually extends to about 82, okay, when you started to see interest rates start to come down finally.
I remember 81, CD rates were like 16%, 15, 16. I remember investing folks' money in bond funds that paid 13. A corporate bond fund.
It's hard to believe nowadays.
Sovereign bond, 13%.
I was just in the office today before I left with a client. She's in her 70s and talking about how you can't get anything in the bank. And it's true. It's hard to believe.
Very difficult.
It's hard to believe the
so
CDs
different.
Were once paying 11, 12%.
I know, huh? And of course, this environment is best for the younger group who borrows.
That is true.
Who don't have a lot of liquid savings yet. Most of you're a young man in your 30s. Most of your money is going to be in your 401k plan, IRA, long-term stuff. So it's not in bank stuff anyway.
Correct.
You know, but if you're 73 years old, like this lady was, you know, and you just want to get a guaranteed safe return on your money, it's tough. It's very tough. And as I mentioned before, I don't, this is just my own, you can call it a crazy opinion if you like, but I don't buy that anything is guaranteed. I've seen pensions default that were guaranteed. I've seen the U.S. government almost default on government bonds a couple of times in 35 years. So I don't mean that in a complete hardish way, but I don't take the word guaranteed in a guaranteed manner myself at all. I don't care where it comes from.
It's a good philosophy to have.
You know, I think if you're a fiduciary especially.
It's that, you know, hope for the best, plan for the worst kind of mentality, I think you have to have.
Yeah, I made a note on it prior to the show today. So, example, if you're looking for a guaranteed return, you may be interested in, as an example, fixed annuities.
Yep.
Guaranteed principal, guaranteed interest, you know, big name insurance company.
Sure.
But in your pursuit of the guarantee, once you get there and you start looking at all these companies that offer these annuity products, which one do you think is going to be offering the highest yield to lure you in?
The one that has the most likelihood of failing.
Correct. Exactly. So it's a hook. It's a bit of a trap.
Well, you have to be compensated for the risk.
That's correct.
Right. So, but there's not supposed to be a risk.
But not supposed to be. But we've learned, right, that sometimes in the world of finance, what shouldn't be sometimes ends up happening.
Very
true. Not supposed to be mountain lions in Cumberland, Rhode Island either, but they could be. Right? At one point or another, you never know, right?
Yeah,
you know. Could be a wanderer.
It could be a zoo that got loose or something. Like that.
You don't know. This is the Money Talk Show, not the Zoo Talk Show on AM 790, your station for talk and business. It's tax time. If you have a funny 1099, like a few clients of ours, we've had that 1099 conversation begins in February and lasts usually till April. A 1099-R means you rolled it over. So you don't usually have to do anything with that. If you got a 1099 by mistake on a rollover, I believe that you can file that 1099 with an explanation and possibly a copy of a statement of where the money went in the rollover, and I think that would be fine most of the time. When you're doing these type of 1099s, when you're rolling money over from 401k plans, you know, you could do it as a in-kind transfer. We don't usually do that because most of the time today, private management is seeking the lowest cost of funds for the client. That's going to be ETFs. So if you've got a traditional mutual fund, although you can roll it over in kind, and occasionally we'll encounter someone who has a fund that's just so wonderful in their 401k plan, we can actually roll over everything else in cash and keep that one fund and hang on to it. Some of the Fidelity funds long-term are that type of fund, I think. And so 1099s are tricky if you're getting them in the mail. Contact the people who issued them first. Don't talk to the IRS because it's going to probably confuse you. Well, go back to the source of what's going on when it comes to that. And keep in mind that seeking complete guarantees can be a bit of a trap in that the product, if you will, that's going to attract you, your eye, with the highest return in that guaranteed category is going to be the one probably with the lowest rating, which means it's a riskier endeavor. This is Nathan and Stephen Bove on the Money Talk Show, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Money Talk Show on AM 790, your station for talk and business. We're here every evening. I'm not, but we, the team, are here every night at 5 p.m. Monday night, the founder of the program, of course, Don Sowa. Tuesday night, Don and his daughter, Donna Grace, joins him with over 10 years' experience now. Both of those cats on that show are Rhode Island Monthly five-star wealth manager winners over the past few years in one program. That's cool. We're working on that one, right, Nate?
Yeah, right.
And Nathan's our youngest member of the team, soon to be certified financial planner professional. That'll be the next step for him. But tonight we're talking about a little bit about history. As always, on Wednesday night, we find a lot of our clients that are, you know, 40, 50 and up enjoy this kind of thing because it's oftentimes a time that they live through. You know, like I'm 57, and I was in my, you know, I told you, I was, you know, age 11,
right, 21. Right. Yeah, anytime you can talk about something that's going to give you perspective, you know, on current situations, you know, and the 70s are a great time to talk about because, like I said, I used the word tumultuous economically. Mm. And even in the 60s, they were as well. I think culturally in the 60s was much more tumultuous when you think about, you know, whether it was the Cuban Missile Crisis or the JFK getting assassinated, Martin Luther King assassinated, the civil rights riots. I mean, the 60s were a crazy, crazy time. And the markets didn't fall apart. And, you know, they came back.
It was still the industrial era.
Yeah, it was still a lot of production going on for sure. But one of the things we'll get into a little later in the second half of the show is how even though you can look at returns on the Dow or the S&P during like the 70s, and they weren't terrible. I mean, the S&P and the S&P averaged about 5.5% a year in the 70s. But when you take into the inflation, if you adjust for inflation,
it was probably negative.
Negative. It was negative.
It was
right?
negative. Right.
So wrapping your head around those kind of concepts and trying to understand how those things react to one another and how to plan for your future and thinking about those things, it can be really difficult. So probably all the more reason to seek out a certified financial planner when you're planning.
Well, somewhat of equal skills.
Yeah, right.
There are those as well.
No doubt about it.
I would think one of the great lessons in these conversations is that when you folks get a little bit older, like my age, and you have hopefully a pile of money saved up for retirement, that you really should be very diversified. Here we're talking about, after inflation, stocks not making a gain at all for a decade. Gold had 30 years where you could own it and you wouldn't make any money. We've all seen people buy real estate and 5 years later, 7 years later, they're still not even on it.
Dow Jones, the S&P in the 2000s.
Another decade of no gain.
Yeah.
I mean, so if you've got a $500,000 IRA, folks, you better have 10 or 12 different things in there. You know, I saw one a while ago that had three holdings. It was a $500,000 account. And that's just not enough diversification in my mind. And the problem is that it had performed very well. And now there's a danger of doing something wrong and winning at it.
Right.
So trying to talk that client into diversifying properly, and they'll say to me, what would the return have been had I done it correctly? And I said, it would have been less. And you call that correctly. Somebody say, you know how this business
sure,
is so hard
sure.
psychologically.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, one of the hardest things to do when you're experiencing an asset or an investment that has appreciated in value is when you go to sell it and you know it's high, is you have to make a decision on what to do with the proceeds. Where do you put the money next? Where is the next opportunity?
And that's what makes the sell hard.
Exactly.
Because it's work. We're holding on to it and hoping it continues to do well is easy.
Exactly. Yeah. And human beings in general do not like change. They'd rather keep what's working and go with it. You know?
That's why if you have a managed account with someone like myself, there's a legal requirements that you actually go through the portfolio, three or four times a year.
Absolutely.
And take a look at things and make sure things are on track for where they're supposed to be. Many of you may be receiving phone calls and forms in the mail. Some of you have actually spoken with Nathan from our office probably in the last week or two or three about the new Department of Labor rules regarding commissions and retirement accounts. It's still not completely clear how far this will continue to go with our new president. But what I do know is that our company, our brokerage company, who is an important part of our professional life, is committed to the concept, our office is, and we are personally as well. The danger of commissions in a retirement account is that initially, when you meet someone, that person may be recommending what pays them the best commission versus what's best for you. Another big problem, Nathan, with commissions and retirement accounts that you never hear anybody talk about, and it's one of the biggest ones, is if a person opens an account and gets paid a very large commission up front, and then that person leaves the business 6 months or a year later, which happens, very high turnover
sure.
in our field.
Sure.
Now the customer comes into that location where they bought the account, the other person got the big fat commission up front and is gone.
Who's going to help you now?
They have arrangements to do to provide service, but it's hard to overcome the human part of, I didn't get paid anything on this.
Right.
We run into accounts like that often where we take over. We step in as a secondary advisor. Somebody else made the big fat commission and walked away, and then we have to manage it for the next 26 years.
Yeah, there's so many.
It's dangerous.
There's so many. The web is very large when it comes to affecting the transaction and relationship between the advisor and the client, obviously. That's one of them you talked about. And there are many we could talk about. I know one of them I had the conversation today on the phone with a client talking about this new DOL ruling and how he said, "Well, I'd like to start spending some of my money." And he was in his late 70s. And I said, "Do it, absolutely. Now's the time."
We always encourage people to enjoy their money.
And he said, "Well, I didn't expect to hear that coming from a financial advisor." You know? I said, "Well, that's because we don't get paid on commissions. You know, advisors get paid on commissions.
We get paid to take care of what's there.
Right. They only get paid when new money comes in the door, so they can't afford to tell you to not put money in the door.
Because the salary will stop.
Right. The salary stops.
Right. So, and when we talk like this, I say this in sympathy for the people that are working in that kind
of
environment.
Sure.
It's very difficult
for them.
It is
very hard. It's cutthroat.
And most want to do the right thing. I'm sure the majority do.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about is just creating a situation in the financial business where it can't happen.
Right.
The abuse can't. We have to have structure where it cannot happen ever. to anyone. We can't leave it to the goodwill of the advisor in that little office in Oklahoma.
Right.
And I'm all for that.
Because yeah. Once you start working in large numbers, it's just the probability is just there. You're going to get, unfortunately,
somebody's
going to
get derailed, ethically derailed.
Right. And every profession you look at anywhere, yeah. There's always going to be good ones or bad ones.
Right. Best example of it, I was doing a financial plan for a couple 10 years ago or more. And when I said to them, let me see your life insurance, they showed me life insurance. And when I said, let me see your retirement account, they showed me life insurance. And when I said, do you have an education fund, they showed me life insurance. And the highest commissionable anything on earth is life insurance. Cash value life insurance. Doesn't mean it's always wrong, folks, but life insurance policies should not be all three of your main financial tools. Life insurance can be a moderate investment if you've already taken advantage of the other opportunities. I have some affluent clients who accumulate money, you know, prior to retirement in life insurance policies, but they can't do anything else.
Right.
They maxed everything, 401k, IRA, their incomes, they're very successful people. And I think when you've already used all those other tools, then I do believe that life insurance can be a reasonable investment,
right.
But only then.
And I got to tell you, I spent a lot of time on the phone today with a couple of insurance companies because one client you're talking, I know you can relate to, you're talking about the situation where he has a few of these products. He's very affluent, so he's very diversified.
Right. Big accounts.
Man, it is like pulling teeth trying to talk to these insurance companies on the phone and get information. And all the client wanted was a 10-year history of the account.
Right.
And they don't provide a 10-year history of the account. They'll provide a 10-year history of the sub-accounts.
The funds inside, right.
But he hasn't held the same funds for all 10 years.
He's made a few changes along the way.
So that's not going to help me get what the client wants.
That's because that's a financial product, not a portfolio, really. It's a product that was sold many, many moons ago. And the reason that he still has it is because if he changed it and broke the character of that and wanted to do something else, he would get a 1099 for about $275,000.
Don't want that.
Which he doesn't want that.
No,
so he's staying. It's a lesser of evils. He's staying there. Yeah. But, yeah, these products are difficult like that because that's what they are. They're financial products. You know, it probably happens to some extent, but it's dangerous in the medical field. If a pill is first designed to profit the company, first and almost exclusively, the quality of it might not be as good. It really should be for the ailment first and figure out a way to make a living doing it, you know, that kind of thing. But the patient has to be first, and that's what these laws are trying to do. They're trying to get an even playing field in the financial planning arena so that no matter who you talk to, if it's retirement money, an IRA, 401k rollover, the advisor can only get paid an ongoing fee over time. And that takes away any potential temptation for selfishness or inappropriate behavior.
And one of the other good things that the new law is pushing is trying to get expenses to be on your statement.
Up front.
You know, if you're working with an advisor and it's just a brokerage account, you could pour through your statements every month, and you're not going to find what it's costing you to have those funds and that advisor. It's built into the mutual fund.
Right.
And this is kind of a weird concept for some people. But let's say the expense ratio on the mutual fund is, say, 1.5%. Well, the first 1.5% the fund makes that year in gains is going to be retained by the mutual fund company because they've got a big wig sitting at a big desk, and he's got a big staff that does a lot of good things.
Retirement plans, health insurance.
Absolutely. And they work hard in trying to figure out which investments to use the mutual fund. So they have legitimate expenses they have to pay for.
Sure.
But you don't see it as a consumer. And the new law is going to make that right in front of your face, which is good.
Look, my clients have managed accounts on their management report. It's listed right there, management fees.
Right, and these new laws are going to push that for all lots.
So so people can evaluate what they're paying and are they getting the right thing. For example, you know, if you've got to make 7 calls to the office, and no one calls you back, and you look at your fee, you say, well, I'm paying these people $6,000 a year. You know, you dosh gone better return the phone call.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to do: put the customer in charge. So they can't be taken advantage of. This is the Money Talk Show with Nathan and Steve Beauvais, and we'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Steve Beauvais, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome back to the Money Talk Show on AM 790, your station for talk and business. 437-5000, 1-888-345-0790. If you've got a tax question or a thought, if we can't answer you tonight, which can happen, we'd be happy to dig into it a little further and get back to you on another night. Remember, the show is on live every evening at 5 p.m. I already mentioned Monday and Tuesday night, Don Soa hosting the show. Tuesday night, his daughter joins him, Donna Grace. Wednesday night, Nathan and I, of course. Thursday night, Don Soa solo, usually. And then Friday night, I wrap things up. Last couple of Fridays, I was kind of sick. Our whole family had this flu thing.
It was brutal.
Oh, the poor little children and grandchildren.
Everyone I talked to had a little bit of
that. Yeah,
in
the office, and Donna's kids, you know.
It's crazy.
And, it seemed to hang on for a while, too.
It was like possessed. Like, it just wouldn't go
evil.
Away.
Evil. It was like evil. Something
just
evil.
Just when you thought you were in the clear.
Something evil came back. So, Nathan, what made the economy so unique during the 70s? It was a kind of a wild time, as you said.
It was, yeah. It was because we had this thing called stagflation. That's kind of what the topic is for tonight, is this idea of stagflation, which is
too many deer.
A combination of the word stagnation and inflation.
Inflation, right.
So we had a very stagnant economy, very low growth, high unemployment, and very high inflation. The classic time in our history where interest rates were the highest they've ever been, were late 1970s, early 1980s. And this term had to be invented because we had never seen this before. Normally, it's very counterintuitive when you think about basic economics.
Yes.
If you have high unemployment, that means people don't have discretionary income, so they're not spending money, which means that prices shouldn't be rising. But we had prices rising, and that's twofold. I think that one,
global demand can be the case today. Well, one country can be out of favor in its cycle where the world is not, and it can be demand from that.
Actually, in developed Europe, they also saw the same thing in the 1960s, and that word stagflation really started to come around in the 60s.
Hangover from the 60s.
Yeah, right. But
I like 60s music too.
The big thing I think that really made that set the table for the inflation was the rise in oil prices in the 1970s. Crude oil skyrocketed.
Oh, and it's in everything.
And energy affects everything.
Right. So the oil's in your tires in your car, brake pads, it's in all kinds of stuff.
But
plastics.
It's built into the chicken that you buy because the chicken has to be transported from one place to another place, and it costs energy to move it.
On tires.
So the cost of energy affects everything.
Just about everything.
So
that's why it's a good investment, I would think, long term, right?
That's right. So the price of oil, barrel of oil, back in the early 70s was right around $3.50. But the middle of 1974, it had raised to $10. It had jumped that high.
A tripling.
Yes. And this was due to the oil embargo of 1973. Which was
somebody cut down production.
not so much production as so much as just we're not going to sell you oil anymore.
Less availability.
Right. So the United States had a lot of power in the oil business in the 50s and the 40s. And the further back you go, the more influence Europe, especially Britain, and the United States had in the Middle East in oil.
Sure.
What we saw in the 1960s and then into the
70s. They had the resources to develop it. The Middle East didn't.
Exactly. That's exactly
cash
right. Exactly right. And or the know-how, the scientists, whatever. But as the decades went on, these communities, whether it was Iran or whether it was Saudi Arabia, started to see, hey, we could benefit from this if we just did it ourselves.
Here you go.
And you can't really blame them.
Not at all.
You know?
Not at all.
So
thanks for what you did.
Yeah, right.
But, we'll take it from here.
So, you know,
not at all.
Saudi Arabia especially has a deep history with American companies producing oil in Middle East, specifically Chevron and Texaco. But anyway, in the late 1960s, Saudi Arabia gradually took over the oil company there, which was a Saudi Aramco, as its name is known today, and decided that we're going to do things on our own. And that was fine, and things were going smoothly. We were buying oil from Saudi Arabia, but things happened politically with wars and us helping Israel. And
blew up somebody I like.
Exactly. That's exactly what happened. Yeah. And so, you know, they just decided we're not going to sell oil to you anymore. And we had become very dependent on foreign oil.
Sure.
It's not like today where you see we are producing lots of oil here in America. That was
Canada and Mexico were two major providers of oil to us.
Yes, but that's because the technology now has allowed us to remove oil in places that we never were able to back in the 70s.
Yes. I wonder if oil in the Middle East was the easiest to get at.
It's like a faucet.
Like a faucet.
You just stick a straw in the ground, it comes out. I mean, it is.
Well said, Nate.
It is remarkably. Once they found it,
and then like the modern shale oil, that's the hardest to get out.
Exactly.
Ever.
Exactly.
Most expensive, most difficult to get out.
Right. So
all affects prices.
Right, and that's how lower prices as they fell on oil really hurt the shale industry because they depended on higher prices to make it profitable to take that oil out of the ground. But, you know, the stock market was not immune to these circumstances in the economy that were going on. So, for example, from 1970 to 1979, we saw about a compound annual growth rate of the S&P is about around 6%. But the average inflation rate during that time was right around 8%. So when you think about it, the real return on the S&P that decade was negative. You actually didn't make your money back because of rising prices. And this just kind of shows how devastating inflation is to an economy. It's worse than unemployment. It's worse than a crashing stock market. The rising prices and drastically rising prices really wreak havoc on every consumer in the economy, no doubt about it.
It gets down to the core of things where people can't afford to eat.
Right.
Terrible,
right.
Rampant inflation.
Yeah. The 70s saw a couple of really bad stock market crashes, too. 1973 and 74 were particularly bad for the S&P, about negative 15 in 73 and negative 27%. In 74.
That's a good chunk.
Yeah, so it happens.
Yes, it does. And it hasn't happened in a while, folks. Make
right.
a note.
Well, I was just talking to one of our clients tonight, the one that you know really well for a long, long time, and she said, it's not a matter of if, it's
when,
a matter of when. And
right.
I said, you're absolutely right. I can't predict when it's going to happen, but I know it is going to happen.
It's like
eventually.
A good jungle guy doesn't know where the lion's going to leap out.
Right.
But he knows how to react.
Right.
He's trained how to react.
So one of the weird things that we saw towards the end of the 70s was this thing called a flattened yield curve. And I don't want to get too nerdy here on the Money Talk show. But most people would understand that if you look at United States Treasuries, the shorter term bonds or bills yield less than the longer term.
Usually, debt
instruments. Right, yeah. So, for example, today a 3-month treasury is paying 0.73%, and the 2-year treasury is paying 1.36%,
right.
And the 30-year is paying 3.15%. So you can see a progress here of the yields going higher and higher.
Another trap.
Yeah, but once in a while, you get to see this situation where the yields start to flatten out. And the difference between the shorter term ones, like the 2-year and, let's say, the 10-year, they get much closer.
It's tighter.
The spread gets much smaller.
Not enough reward for tying the money up.
Right. So right now, if you look at the spread between the 10-year treasury and the 3-month treasury, you're looking at about 2.8% difference. But there have been times in our economy where the spread is actually negative. It doesn't happen very often, and it doesn't happen for very long. It's very quick.
Yeah.
But if you look at, say, in like 1989, we saw the spread between the 3-month treasury and the 10-year treasury get negative. Right before the 2000 crash, negative. Right before the 2008 crash, negative. So if you look back in the last 30 or 40 years...
A lot of money hiding in safety?
Yeah, it's complicated stuff, and I would probably defer someone with more experience on it. But I do know when you look at the charts and the data, this flattened or inverted yield curve
inverted yield curve I'm talking about,
where the spread between the short-term and long-term gets negative... It's really remarkable. The recession happens almost, it's 4 for 4, the last 4 recessions. You see this negative spread and followed by the
recession. And, of course, the $64,000 question is, what's the spread right now?
Well, between the 10-year and the 3-month, it's about 2.8. And this has been slowly declining since 2010, where it was almost about 4%. So it's been coming down. It lasts like 6 months. It was going up. But the overall trend since 2010 is down. Where it's going to go next, hey, I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell you.
We don't engage in predictions.
But what I can tell you is that of the last 4 recessions that we've experienced in our economy, they were all predated or by these negative yield curves. And very shortly before that, like almost 6 months.
You could use that in investing, and not to leave the market, but to be lighter on it.
Absolutely.
At certain times. You could use it in certain careers. You could rely on consumer optimism to drive your business, like a landscaper or things that people can do without, you know that sort of thing.
Very true.
I remember my dad telling me, he was a mechanic all his career, and telling me that his business was kind of recession-proof. The last thing people think about is buying a new car during a recession.
You sure?
So what are you going to do? Fix the old one.
Right,
And you can't get to work without it.
Right. Or if you got the reserves, go into the store, go into the car store.
Best deal ever.
Every salesman will run up to you.
Yep.
They haven't seen a customer in 2 months.
I did it once in the down market, bought I think the only new vehicle ever, and you're right, got a crazy price on it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Was that the Yukon? That was that year?
That was a Jeep.
It was a Jeep,
way back, yeah, that gold Jeep, yeah. But I don't like new cars in general. They're very pricey. I think it's a nice reward, you know, at the tail end of your career. Unless that's your thing. You know, I've met men along the journey who, clients of mine, and say to me, I listen to you talk about cars on the radio, but that's my thing. I said, that's fine. I mean, you got to have a hobby. So
sure.
If that's the only thing that you do and you're not spending money on anything else, that's what you love and enjoy, then I agree with you completely. As long as you don't have credit cards at 22%.
Right, right.
You know, you get the other stuff in line, then,
right.
then go ahead and do it. But the, you know, the anti-new car thing for me is really geared towards people Nathan's age in their 30s that are building their financial life.
Sure.
And I just think if you avoid the new cars, you get there a lot quicker, less stress, less worry. And a new car for younger people is like putting rocks in your backpack. It's just going to make your journey more difficult.
Yeah, anytime you saddle up a $400 a month payment, it's tough, you know.
I can't take it.
It's tough.
I haven't had a car payment in so long.
You know, I mean,
I buy 10-year-old, sometimes an 8 or 10-year-old car to drive myself. Yeah.
You know, but I mean, you do see situations, especially if you have the income, if you're a decent earner, and you can afford it. Sometimes a new car can be a good investment.
I'm sure it can in certain circumstances.
If you drive that car for 15 years, you know, and you
keep it that long, it's going to be a good value.
It's going to be a good investment.
I agree.
But
most people don't do that.
Most people don't do that. You have to hang on to it. You know?
The average car that's registered right now is 12 years old. I heard that on the radio the other day, right here on 790, some kind of report.
I guess I would have guessed a little lower, but...
I would have said a little lower.
Maybe 9. Yeah,
but they last a lot longer, you know?
Yeah, true.
Than they ever did before.
I wonder what it was.
Not the cars from the 70s.
I was going to say.
Remember those Gremlins and Matadors and, was it a Pacer? They were the ugliest things I've ever seen. How did they sell those things?
Sometimes they just didn't start. I mean, that doesn't happen now, right? You never go out to your car and turn the key and it just doesn't start. You know?
No, never.
Never.
No,
that would happen in the 60s and the 50s.
Oh, it would have. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Hey, this is Nathan and Steve Bove on Money Talk Night, History Night, here on AM 790, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Money Talk Show. History Night on Wednesdays on the Money Talk Show. Nathan and I. And for those of you who haven't connected yet, Nathan's my son and the youngest member of the team here on the Money Talk Show. He's in charge of History Night on Wednesdays. Nathan, what did the government do to try to combat this wild inflation that they had in the 70s?
Yeah, so the obvious thing that the governments do when inflation is happening is raise interest rates to combat the inflation. But that didn't seem to be enough at the time. And so one of the things I was going to talk about tonight was this special address that Gerald Ford made, President Gerald Ford did, in October of 1974, which he addressed Congress and the American people to try to rally the troops, in a way, to get things done here. And whip inflation now, as the famous speech became.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, win.
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 Whip inflation.
They actually came up with a domestic program for this and gave away buttons that said win.
Yeah.
And T-shirts.
It's a collector's item.
It is.
Political collector's item, yeah. That win button.
Win button, yeah. Mm. And other things like T-shirts and gym bags I saw, sweaters, like a really ugly sweater that said, like, win. It was just bizarre. But anyway, so some of the things that Ford talked about in his address to Congress that day was increasing things like food supply and lowering regulations on farmers to try to increase supply of goods to bring the prices down. Obviously, the oil thing was huge. You know, he talked about American citizens carpooling and trying to produce more oil at home. There's also capital shortages, which he talked about. He used tax credits for industries that were heavily dependent on capital, like public utilities. Expanded unemployment benefits. Unemployment was very high at that time. Housing stimulation was also a big part of his speech. Unemployment in construction was twice as high as the national average at that time. And thrift institutions were also under fire. And we talked about last week, savings and loans crisis. So he addressed that. He also proposed and implemented a one-year temporary increase in taxes, which was a 5% surcharge on corporate and upper-level incomes, which included households under $15,000, or but today would be about $74,000 today, just a one-year. But, you know, he addressed the American people, and I was going to read a little bit of his speech tonight to kind of give you an idea of
Fascinating.
What things were going, how things were going on. He said, here is what we must do, what each and every one of you can do. And he's talking, addressing the American public at this time. To help increase food and lower prices, grow more and waste less. To help save scarce fuel in the energy crisis, drive less, heat less. Every housewife knows almost exactly how much she spent for food last week. If you can spare a penny from your food budget, and I know every, I know there are many, surely you can cut the food that you waste by 5%. Every American motorist knows exactly how many miles he or she drives to work or to school every day and about how much miles she or he runs up each year. If we all drive at least 5% fewer miles, we can save almost unbelievably 250,000 barrels of foreign oil a day. By the end of 1975, most of us can do better than 5% by carpooling, taking the bus, riding bikes, or just plain walking. We can save enough gas by discipline to meet our 1 million barrels per day goal. I think there is one final thing that all Americans can do, rich or poor, and that is share with others. We can share burdens as we can share blessings. Sharing is not easy. Not easy to measure the like mileage and family budgets, but I am sure that 5% more is not nearly enough to ask. So I ask you to share everything you can and a little bit more, and it will strengthen our spirits as well as our economy. And it's kind of interesting to contrast that about to what I grew up in, which was the Great Recession, which was the exact opposite. The government was telling you to spend.
You money.
They were giving me money. I got a check in the mail for $300 right. From the Obama stimulus.
I had forgotten about that.
Yeah. You know, so it's so funny how you can go from one extreme in one generation to another extreme and another generation. And I'm sure a few generations from now we'll be back at the other extreme or some other kind of extreme. You know,
driving an economy is like a beginner driving a bicycle. Do you remember when you were learning a bicycle, how you oversteered all the time?
Yeah.
When you're going to go left, you go too far left.
Sure.
When you want to go learn how to drive a boat, it's the same way. You oversteer when
right.
you're learning.
Yeah.
And that's how economies are. They're always oversteering. Whatever they do it too much, so it takes them back to the center point and then beyond on the other side.
Right. The famous analogy is pushing on a string when yes. the government makes economic decisions. It doesn't really do what they want. If you want the string to go forward, how do you got to pull it? You can't push it, you know?
Right, right.
So... It is very, it's extremely complicated. There's so many distortionary effects.
And... we have, you know, I have almost 40 years experience, and Nathan and I sit in my office in Lincoln on occasion, and I just say to him, is this the craziest business you've ever seen?
Yeah, it's,
I mean,
it's
really is
challenging because so much changes every year, and and then take into consideration history, which I love, and study, that can help a lot too. But by Gerald Ford served only a short term, less than, I think it was a little more than 4 years. Yeah, I think it was. But he famously took over for Richard Nixon when he resigned. And Ford was the only president not to be elected president. And that's because Nixon's vice president, who he originally ran with on the ticket, had to resign because of corruption charges. And then Nixon had to resign because of corruption.
The vice president had a funny name or a unique name.
Agnew.
Spiro Agnew.
Yeah. So Ford was the first president never to be elected. It was pretty a unique situation.
Fascinating. And there's your walk through financial history on the Money Talk show. Every Wednesday night, we spend the last half of the show talking about interesting topics we hope you find interesting. About a time in all of our lives, not only on a financial basis, but some of it's political as well. We even talked a little bit about architecture in Newport in the beginning of our history lesson.
Sure, yeah.
Hey, tune in tomorrow night for Don Sowa right here on the Money Talk Show on AM 790, your station for talk and business.
Bye.